And we start with film reviews, two up for consideration tonight. Firstly, Jesse Buckley, fast becoming one of the most in-demand actors on the big screen, small screen and stage, is back on the big screen alongside co-star Rory Kinnear in a movie simply called Men, directed by Alex Garland. Men is described by one website as a sickening brew of horrors. May not be to everybody's taste, I would guess. Also in the mix today, Bergman Island, focusing on husband and wife team of film director Tony and screenwriter Chris. The couple go on a creative retreat to the Swedish island of Faro, the home place of the great Swedish director Ingmar Bergman. That gives the movie its name. Vicky Creeps and Tim Roth take the central roles. Justin McGregor, Tara Brady have seen them both. They're with me in studio this evening. And we'll start with men, Jesse Buckley, who in fact will be with us in a couple of weeks' time, speaking about her new album with Bernard Butler. She was quoted recently as saying, "I like the extremes of opinion it's going to instill in people," presumably talking about Men. Now, before we get into the extremities of opinion that I think both Justin and Tara might be about to express, can we have an outline? Who will I go to? Tara, of the plot, please.
Well, as you say, it's horrors, plural. Like, it's kind of brew of interesting ideas from the writer-director of Annihilation and Ex Machina. So, as you'd expect, because he's a big concept-driven guy. So, as Men opens, Harper, who's played by Jesse Buckley, who's always brilliant in everything, she goes to a rural English village to recuperate from the apparent suicide of her late husband. She's greeted there by a country gent played by Rory Kinnear, who seems to have wandered in from a League of Gentlemen sketch, and wandering around her supposedly, you know, tranquil location, she runs into a creepy naked man, also played by Rory Kinnear. When he reappears later on that night, she does what any normal human being should have done a while back and calls the police, and the policeman turns up and he's also Rory Kinnear. So you get the idea,
right.
And the idea is that it's this kind of mix of English folk horror and systemic misogyny.
Yeah.
Those are the big ideas.
And I suppose it's not a budgetary issue to have Rory Kinnear playing all of these men, and given the title of the film and the director Alex Garland, as Tara mentioned, we're talking about high concepts, if you think about it, Annihilation, Ex Machina. What is that the concept? What is the high concept? What is the philosophy that he's coming at here?
Well, you spend a lot of time thinking about that while you're watching the movie, which isn't necessarily a great thing to do while watching a movie. I think the idea is that it's like an amorphous man, that, you know, one man is all men in these kind of different guises, you know, under different layers of onions, or however you want to, again, think about it.
And does he keep giving, I don't know if giving birth is the right phrase, but kind of pouring forth the new incarnation of Rory Kinnear?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because some of them get really close to like a Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge kind of sketch sort of level. So some of them are much more realistic than others, like the police officer and the bartender are just like a police officer and a bartender. But certainly Jeffrey, who owns the country estate, and
the naughty little boy.
The naughty little boy.
When they project Rory Kinnear's face onto the naughty little boy, it's like, oh, right,
yeah.
Good luck.
All right, okay.
Yeah, so I think that's the concept that's going on there, and that all men underneath are misogynistic and really just want to be giving birth themselves, which is a literal description of the third act.
Yes.
Because that's what we see.
Yeah, we see them all the Rory Kinnears give birth to all the other Rory Kinnears in these kind of vaginal ways with blood everywhere. And then at the very end, her dead husband comes out of one of the Rory Kinnears' mouth.
All right. Well, I'm not surprised then that she makes a phone call and is a bit scared about who's coming to her house. Here's a clip from Men, and really the voice you'll hear here is Jesse Buckley.
Please stay on the line.
I am staying on the line.
Are you alone in the house?
That's Harper, played by Jesse Buckley, and we can hear in the distance then somebody on the other side of the phone taking the 999 call. And we were saying as we were listening to that, Tara, you know, that's a very good sound clip. It's a really good sound design here and a great world that's created.
There's really individually great little bits. There's like lovely sound design and really great use of music. There's really great visual flourishes, like the stuff with the dandelion fluff, the repeated kind of motif of that. And you get a thing like you get these like sort of creepy ley line type English figures in the church and the light pouring in and then them going dark again. And like I think probably the best sequences of the film is near the very, very early on in the film when Jesse Buckley is strolling and comes across an abandoned railway tunnel. It's just it's really beautifully directed sequence, and it's really, really creepy and really well done. But I think the problem is that all these individual things, they don't really congeal into anything particularly gripping, and the one character, you know, all men thing just doesn't. It's very flashy every time, but it just keeps distracting you. It keeps pulling you out of the film. So you have these like engrossing moments, and then these things that are repeatedly pulling you out of the film. And there's another issue is that like the men themselves are very kind of shallowly written and almost comically written. And I can't help but wonder that if it was written maybe by a woman rather than a man who's like experiencing these things at one remove, maybe the aren't all men awful idea might have, you know, had a little bit more grounding or earthiness or experience to it rather than this sort of cartoonish tropes that you're presented with all the way through.
And I suppose that there are two central performances here. Jesse Buckley has a real character to play. Rory Kinnear kind of, is he forced into giving a here's my box of tricks type of performance?
No, a little bit. Like it is a distraction. Like, you know, you know, sometimes you have these great concepts, I think, as a filmmaker, and then the execution of them just is never really going to work. So you're thinking about, oh, that's a different, you know, set of false teeth for this character. Like you really are like looking to see how they, you know, what they're doing and how they're making him different. And you never forget that it's the same person. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when Alec Guinness would do this in the comedies, you would forget that it was Alec Guinness taking on those different roles, you know, in the 50s and 60s in those kind of Ealing comedies. Whereas here, it feels like a real, you know, distraction. But I mean, some of it, you know, some of his work is good. And then Jesse Buckley seems to be put in this position of, she has some great reactions and some really good stuff going on with her. But then she also has to say what about 20 times after men speak. Now, I don't know if that's meant to be a satire on mansplaining, but like somebody will say, like the priest goes, it's your fault that he died, and it's, what? And then they re-explain what they've just said. Like, it happens so many times, it will be a drinking game one day.
Yeah, and I suppose it possibly is a play on mansplaining there, because Garland is a good director.
He definitely usually is. I think maybe the material for this is just, it feels a little bit thin, it feels a little bit overstretched, I think. And then the problem is that the big body horror set pieces where it's like kind of like sub Cronenbergian stuff at the end, it feels like it belongs to an entirely different movie. It doesn't really feel organic to this film at all. And also worth noting, he kind of loses all pacing in that final sequence. The final sequence, for all the gore and the blood, is really boring. It's really, really slow, and it just, you're kind of sitting there going, oh yeah, okay, vaginal horror, yawn, and which shouldn't be happening with given what's happening on the screen.
Just one further question. We've mentioned Jesse Buckley and working here. Are there any other actors that have anything of real substance?
There's a female police officer who I think has two lines, and then she has a best friend who Riley, played by Gail Rankin. And she's there to FaceTime with and give someone for Jesse Buckley to talk to about all these kind of things that are going on. And some of that, like the use of the phone, there's a time she sends Riley the map of where she is and the reply seems to come from one of the Rory Kinnear characters. There are those little moments that really actually are spine-tinglingly good horror. And it's like, how to direct all of that into a devastating ending.
Sounds like a bit an unfortunate misfire kind of opportunity that kind of could have broken out but perhaps didn't. Stars from you, Justin?
Yeah, well, I think divisive is the word. I think it's going to get a lot of ones and a lot of fives. So I went, three?
Yeah, on the fence. And Tara?
Well, I'm closer to the one end of things. I couldn't give it more than two in good conscience, really.
All right. I think neither of you will be rushing back to see Men again, somehow or other. Let's move on to film number two. Bergman Island. Vicky Creeps stars as a screenwriter called Chris Tim Roth. as her director husband, Tony, and the Bergman Island in question is Faro, although there's a wonderful pronunciation of it several times from those who really know how to do those funny O's that the Swedish can do. The couple retreat to write their next film. So take it from there, Justin. So they arrive on the island.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those films that unfolds very slowly. Like, we see most of the actual journey, you know, onto the ferry and from the ferry to the retreat. You know, we see lots of GPS. They really kind of allow it to unfold quite slowly. They get to this retreat and we begin to learn that, oh, they're both writing their next films. You know, she's shown a lot of her promise, but I guess with her early film or films, we don't really find out that kind of detail. And Tim Roth is going to have a showing of his film by the Bergman Foundation. So it's obviously quite well established. And they're both sort of struggling, or she's struggling a bit more on writing the story, and as she begins to get inspired, she meets some other people. She meets a guy, a student there, a film student, who maybe tempts her but really inspires her to start giving her the groundings of a story, which she starts to tell, and then it becomes a film in a film. So
let's hold off on the film within the film just for a second. We'll stick with Tony and Chris, who are the pair on the island going through they're kind of looking for inspiration, but they have a place to stay on Bergman Island, and they have to sort out who's going to be sitting at what window. So here is a little exchange between Vicky Creeps and Tim Roth.
Oi.
Hey. You can't be sitting up here. We can wave at each other.
Wow.
Don't you think it's too nice to...
To what?
Beautiful. All this calm and perfection. I find it oppressive.
Soothing.
Yeah, but I didn't realize, you know, writing here, how can I not feel like a loser? I'm even afraid to sit at a desk.
Right outside, then.
A lot of people come here to work. Students, writers, designers.
No one's expecting persona.
Yeah, well, thank God for that.
Tony and Chris, played by Tim Roth and Vicky Creeps, are in a scene from Bergman Island. I suppose when you set a film on Bergman Island and you have Bergman in the title of the film, there's going to be a lot of Bergman in it.
Well,
you would think.
You would think so. I mean, I thought, right, well, if ever we get off this damn ferry, and we do eventually, although it takes a while, then, you know, and we get to the location. But I remember thinking, okay, we've got the kind of scenes from a marriage bed, and we've got this entire setup, and presumably their marriage is going to turn into something like scenes from a marriage. But you never actually get that kind of Bergman-esque angst or anything, or existential dread. It's sort of, they're very comparatively light problems. I would say, you know, it's one woman looking to finish her screenplay and trying to crib off her more talented and more famous husband. And I like that aspect of it also made me a little bit uncomfortable. But one of the things I found really baffling about the title, you know, and the location, which should be very evocative, although the fact they've come in summer when it's very when it's very sunny, and I think someone does say during the film, well, you should come here in winter. But it doesn't feel at all like a Bergman film in the end, and it feels like something that was made by someone who not only has never seen a Bergman film but didn't even read the Wikipedia entry. There's no overlap there.
Expecting a bit more in for sure.
A little
bit more darkness in terms of, although what we do see is beautiful to look at, but they go in on these various Bergman events, I suppose. There's the Bergman safari that Tony goes on. She goes off on a different path with that guy who I'll come back to, who's a real life filmmaker, which is an interesting aspect of the film. But then the guides and those who are bringing them on those places, they are the actual guides to all of these places on Bergman Island.
Yeah, no, it has... It has, and I actually like them the most, it has these sort of almost documentary-like moments when, say, they're having lunch and people are just telling stories about Ingmar Bergman, going, well, you know, how he had this many children with this many wives and that kind of thing, and, you know, great art, but he wasn't a great person and all that kind of... And those are actually kind of really interesting, but the performances were... It was clear that these were the tour guides, the people from
doing
the Bergman Foundation doing their kind of story. And it even, I think, you know, the film crew was probably even some of the extras. There's a wedding in one section, you know, was sort of part of all that. So that stuff was kind of, you know, even a little bit interesting parts of the safari. But yeah, their actual angst was so kind of light and self-obsessed almost that it just didn't hook you
emotionally. Well, it also, it didn't seem to go very far. But then suddenly in the middle of it, we're into another film, a film within the film. So what's happening in that film within the film, Tara?
Well, again, it's kind of a not particularly fascinating couple. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of a nice enough little conceit. It's like a young woman played by Mia Wasikowska, and she hooks up with a former lover at a wedding, and he's played by the Joachim Trier regular Anders Danielsson Lee, who also turns up later. And this is where, and the sort of film within the film, I mean, it's fine. There's another film within a film that we don't see, which is, you know, the film that that Tim Roth's character is made, which is the one he's there to introduce, which he describes as it's about how invisible things circulate within a couple. So there are these things that should be some kind of commentary or should be some kind of adjunct to the other marriage that's on screen, but not really. Like, nothing in these in these individual things is happening, you know, and there's nothing really meaty enough to justify any of it, really.
Well, let's listen to a clip between Mia Wasikowska and Anders Danielsson as Amy and Joseph. Now, they were lovers. They've had kind of a couple of goes. Timing was wrong. One of them, he loved her. She didn't love him. She loved him. He didn't love her. And now the chemistry is still bubbling away in the background, as we'll hear here.
What are you doing?
Looking at the stars.
I'm gonna go.
Okay. How?
I rented a bike.
Do you think you can ride it?
You're not inviting me up to the Bergman suite?
We're not free, Mrs. Bergwoman. Need I remind you?
First of all, don't call me Mrs. I'm not married. And secondly, don't patronize me. Is that all?
You're the one who doesn't want to.
Me?
Yeah, I can tell.
You pulled away. You...
Will you come pick me up by bike tomorrow morning?
Anders Danielsson and Mia Wasikowska in the, I suppose, the film within the film of Bergman Island. In some ways, you know, I kind of found myself more interested in the dynamic between that couple. At least there was some drama. Will they or won't they get together? Whereas the screenwriter and director, you just kind of thought, get on with doing your job. You're there on a lovely island. Write your script and do your work.
No, there's no real drama in we'll call it the real story, in kind of this main story of Chris and Tony. There's no real drama. Like, someone's got writer's block or doesn't know how their film ends. That's not a particularly, you know, big hook. And we don't get a sense that there's huge problems in their marriage because they, you know, they communicate really well. They're very supportive of each other, you know, and all that kind of thing. So you're just not quite sure, where the scene from the marriage is kind of in this film between them.
But then I mentioned this character of Hampus, who is Hampus Nordenson, who's an actual filmmaker who gets involved with the Vicky Creeps character, Chris. When I say get involved, they meet up, they're chatting. There's a little bit of chemistry there, perhaps, you don't know. But then the film within the film and the film that we're watching about Vicky Creeps and Tim Roth's characters, they kind of merge together without giving too much away. So that meta thing obviously becomes quite important. Is this the nod to Bergman?
I don't know that it is, and for me, none of the meta stuff really works. I mean, I think it's sort of it sort of feels very, very forced, and it also feels really tacked on. It feels like they like, because you know, it's quite a long film, and it doesn't feel like the film before it has justified any of that. It just feels like this might be an idea to do this, and it's like, yeah, but I had to go on that really long ferry ride to get here. I mean, really,
yeah. So it kind of that last half hour didn't have the payoff. But will Bergman aficionados be watching this? Because I wondered, if I knew Bergman's films backwards, would I be saying, oh yes, that's exactly the same shot as in such and such a film, or there's the teacup that was used in whatever, you know?
Yes and no. I think if you're a real, you know, cinephile of Bergman, there's a few little things. There's a scene where Amy and Joseph and their friends run in the water naked, which is from Summer with Monica, and I think the camera's in the same place on the beach, and there's the windmill that there's stuff that I think you have a lot of fun kind of identifying, but really just to show off to your friends after the film's over.
Okay. Stars from you, first of all, Tara.
Two.
You're in a two mood tonight. And Justin?
Well, I really like the cinematography. Denis Lenoir works with natural light, and it was really, really great. It made me want to visit the island. I really like the little Bergman details. It's meh as a film, but it had just enough going for it that I'll sit safely on the fence with a three.
A three. Twos and threes all around the place tonight for our two movies. Tara, we spoke to you, actually, just as we finish up, we spoke to you from the south of France at the beginning of the Cannes Film Festival. Obviously, you're back with us in the land of the scene, now it would seem. What were the big talking points from Cannes?
So I suppose we'll talk about the awards with the big. It's the second Palme d'Or win for Ruben Östlund.
Is it deserved?
Very deserved, I think. I think Triangle Sadness is like, it's properly hilarious. It's a satire aimed at super rich. It follows these two influencers onto a super yacht where they encounter this series of noxious billionaires, and you have Woody Harrelson's drunken communist captain, having rows with a capitalist Russian. That alone would justify the film. And then they get shipwrecked on an island, and that's when the film really takes off. Okay. Probably the longest vomiting sequence in vomiting sequence in movie history. We saw it close then. Lucas Dons.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Yeah.
That ended up being, well, we talked about two films last week. Yeah. One which was one of my favourites, which was Close, and one which was probably the worst film I saw at Cannes, and the worst film of Claire Denis's career, and they tied for the second place. It stars at noon, the really pointless sex.
So you were very happy with Luca Dant, and you were not happy with the Claire Denis prize.
That would be a thing. There was a lot of good films from sort of very solid films from sort of big name directors. So the Dardenne brothers came back with Tori and Lakita, which is a drama about immigrant kids from Africa and Belgium. It's probably their best film since they last won the Palme d'Or with L'Enfant in 2007, and they got a special 75th anniversary prize. So it was a bit on Prizes for All. And we got EO, which Jerzy Skolimowski's film that won. It's a kind of loose remake of O Hazar Balthazar, the Bresson film about the little donkey, probably the saddest film ever made. Completely kind of jagged, all over the place movie, but very, very engaging nonetheless. And that tied with Eight Mountains, which is a new film from the team behind The Broken Circle Breakdown.
That was for the jury prize, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then we have old boy filmmaker Chanwook Park. He got Best Director for Decision to Leave, which is a very strong film. Song Kang-ho, the Parasite star, won Best Actor for Broker, which is a new film from Corrida.
No prize for Baz Luhrmann, but the Presleys did okay.
The Presleys did do okay. So it seems kind of only appropriate. Elvis's granddaughter, Riley Keough, she won Camera d'Or for her directorial debut with War Pony. I think the only disappointment in terms of prizes for me, I really liked the Christian Mungo film, ORMG, which is set in a Transylvanian village. It's where three Sri Lankan bakers move in, and suddenly everyone who are all of whom work in either Hungary or Germany are complaining that these people are coming to take their jobs, and it becomes this complete powder keg of like village meetings and
so
outraged
that's
locals.
One to watch out
yeah,
for
that,
when
that's
it comes.
Definitely one.
And give
to
me one watch. Of maybe something that is kind of one of the there'll always be the kind of the never not really spoken about. Was there one or two?
Yeah, well,
there
we talked about Godland, which was really great last week. But yeah, a really good one. I saw a Russian film which I really loved. It was like this grunge couple, and it's like their whole movies from the early part of the century. And she's pieced together an entire film from these home movies. How to Save a Dead Friend, absolutely terrific. It was a really good American indie about comic book nerds and about how awful they are, called Funny Pages. ages. There was a new Cronenberg film, which we talked about as well. And I will say that a very disappointing year for Léa Seydoux. I saw only two films featuring sex scenes with Léa Seydoux this year, compared to last year when I watched five. There was she was in a sixth film, but there was only five with lengthy sex scenes. So, I don't know. She's got a bit of ground to make up, but I did see a Swiss relationship drama called 99 Moons that was like basically 2 hours of sex. So that just about, you know, that offset the difference.
Well,
I
you
think.
Can choose which of those to watch out for when they come to the cinema near you, as undoubtedly those Cannes selected films will. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
Mr. Tambourine Man from 1965 Bob Dylan album, bringing it all back home. Bob Dylan aficionados will know that that song was inspired by Bruce Langhorne, who played various instruments on the album, including a Turkish drum, which gave rise to the name Mr. Tambourine Man. That drum is one of thousands of pieces now on display at the Bob Dylan Museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma. 29,000 square feet, $10 million center has just opened. And to tell us about it, I'm joined by Sean Latham, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at the University of Tulsa, where he serves as Director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies. And Sean, in fact, you were with us last May celebrating Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. Obviously, he has just turned 81 and the legacy seems to grow with each passing year and very much celebrated now with this museum. How vital was it, do you think, to gather together quite a lot of material, it has to be said, of Bob Dylan's and put it together in one place, as has been done with this museum?
I mean, you know, in some sense, I think gathering all the material together was relatively easy because Dylan, it turns out, had kept all of this material over the course of his long and distinguished career. So the George Kaiser Family Foundation was able to acquire almost all of this entire archive in one go. A few pieces have been added subsequently. So the real challenge, I think, was to figure out when you have these 100,000 objects or more that have been collected, how do you actually use them to help make sense of Bob Dylan and why he matters as an artist, as a writer, you know, as a Nobel laureate?
And has just as a thumbnail, has this museum succeeded in making sense of that huge body of work, both in terms of the songs themselves, but these pieces of paraphernalia that are connected with Bob Dylan and his work?
Yeah, I think it's done a terrific job. In some ways, of course, I'm a terrible person to judge such a thing. I've spent a lot of my career studying Dylan and his work. But when the center opened, I took my wife next door, who's not necessarily much of a Dylan fan. And we spent our time going through it, which it tells the story of Dylan's life and also takes deep dives into individual songs that he's recorded over the course of his career. And we left and she finally said, for the first time in our marriage, "This Bob Dylan guy is actually quite interesting. I think I want to learn more." So I think that's probably the best endorsement I can offer of what they've accomplished.
Yeah, I suppose that it is always the difficulty with a building or a museum like this. You know, how do you go about it? You want to cater for the absolute aficionado, the expert like yourself, but you also want to cater for a broader visitor body that might have a passing interest or a little knowledge around Bob Dylan. So that is the challenge, as you say. The museum is housed in what was a paper factory. We're going to tweet a picture of it now on our own Twitter account, at RTE Arena, if you want to have a look at this. That building itself, how was it acquired? How is there some kind of nice link between it, the fact that it was a paper factory and there's so much material in it now?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't really actually thought about it that way before, because the same building also holds the Woody Guthrie Center. It holds the Bob Dylan Institute, a couple of other museums. It's actually a vast warehouse in what was once a sort of terrible part of Tulsa. It was all abandoned warehouses. When I moved here as recently as 2015, this was essentially an abandoned part of town. And George Kaiser Family Foundation, who had acquired the Dylan Archive, also built essentially an arts district in the middle of Tulsa that includes parks, museums, and this extraordinary building that holds all of these museum collections that the foundation has been acquiring.
And I suppose that link with the Woody Guthrie Center and, as you say, the George Kaiser Foundation, who are also involved in the Woody Guthrie Center, Dylan himself a devotee of Woody Guthrie, the two things so close to each other is quite an interesting placement.
Yeah, you know, it's terrific. On a single day in Tulsa, you can walk from one corner of this building to the other. You can start with Woody Guthrie and the sort of the muse of Oklahoma and this kind of, you know, the sort of inventor of a political folk music that did so inspire Dylan early in his career to go to New York, spend an hour learning about Woody Guthrie and the songs he wrote about Oklahoma, and then come down the street to see how that tradition morphed into the sort of enormous creativity of Dylan, who sort of took what Guthrie had done and built it out into something, you know, that's now, in, as you said, essentially a 60 plus year career.
And I mean, it does kind of tickle my fancy, the idea that the tambourine, or the Turkish drum, as it is, is actually there, that inspired the song, or inspired the name at any rate, Mr. Tambourine Man. Is that the nature of the exhibits? Are they linked directly into the work of Bob Dylan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because this thing was built around the archive, and the archive itself consists primarily of, not of jackets and tambourines. Those are sort of nice little additions and things you put behind glass but can't do very much with. Right, the archive itself consists of hundreds, maybe thousands of unpublished songs and song lyrics and drafts and letters, abandoned versions of songs on tapes, films, photographs. So there's just a vast amount of material that can be on display here that's not just going to see a guitar and a jacket and the tambourine, but you can see the process on a piece of paper and then on studio tapes of how Dylan sort of took an idea and eventually, you know, over the course of maybe a year's worth of work or more, transformed it into Joker Man, or sometimes picked up a song that he'd abandoned a decade or more before, transformed it and rewrote it into something new. So it's like being able to look, sort of look into the secret workshop of a genius and see how do songs actually get made. And you can see that they're actually quite a lot of work, that Dylan is a diligent, hardworking student of American musical traditions, of folk music traditions. And you can see all of that work come out in the way this museum has created its displays.
And I guess that level of knowledge, or that level of exhibit and of examination of the various abandoned papers that might re-emerge later on in a song, you know, two, three decades on, that really is for the more scholarly, or for those who are real fans or have a real interest in Dylan.
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I mean, I think most people think, oh, what is a pop song? You have three chords and you write some words that rhyme, right? I mean, how hard can it be? Anybody can do it. And then I think, when, even if you're sort of a novice when it comes to Dylan, to see actually, oh no, this is a complicated process, right? It is a creative process. It's got all of these different streams flowing into it. It's not something you can just pick three chords and a couple of couplets and say, there, I wrote a pop song. So I think it still offers something even for somebody that doesn't know about Dylan, to say, oh, this is a real form of art, right? This is something that took labor and knowledge that I don't have, that wouldn't allow me to become a pop star, for example.
Yeah, and I suppose the idea that the presumption maybe that in the case of somebody like Bob Dylan, that the songs just rolled out of them. He sat down, wrote them down, picked up his guitar, and he had a tune, and that was it. It was done in 5 minutes. That's not quite how it worked.
No.
But there was, and I think this is an exhibit or a set of exhibits that was of particular interest to you, a huge bag of unopened mail. Tell us a little bit about what that mail was and when it arrived and why it remained unopened.
Yeah, to me, this is one of the great sort of hidden treasures in the archive. When we first got the list of the inventory, I remember just seeing it was kind of separated out because it wasn't something that Dylan himself had written. It was just said moldy bag of mail or something like that. And this is actually a giant U.S. postal bag of mail. Mm. That held thousands of fan letters that had been delivered to Dylan in 1967, the sort of most fateful year of his career, the year of the motorcycle accident, the year he goes just after he's gone electric and has sort of created the version of the modern rock star. We have essentially this time capsule of people writing to Dylan from all over the world. The letters were clearly saved by accident. They just kind of got shoved into a corner, sat in this mailbag for 50 years. And kind of, as I said, they literally got moldy. Mm. The first thing that some of my students had to do was literally clean them. They had to put on protective gear, clean all the mold off. And it turns out none of the letters had been opened. So each letter is itself a kind of time capsule where we're looking to see what did people think of Dylan? What kinds of things did they send to him in this epical moment of his career? And there's all kinds of stuff in there, letters from soldiers in Vietnam, letters from teenage fans who have gotten his name from a magazine, and then all kinds of just odd things, like a planchette from a Ouija board. Clearly, this fan hoped that Dylan would be able to spiritually communicate with him
via
by sharing this thing. Yeah.
One particular, you mentioned their letter, one particular letter from a Vietnam veteran writing, having lost his friends in the field. Very moving the way he spoke about what Dylan's music provided for him that far away from home.
Yeah, it's a machine gunner from Dylan. I think he doesn't exactly say where he got Dylan's address, but we think it must have been from Playboy magazine. Actually, he just said a magazine he found around the base, and it gives you a sense here that Dylan's music wasn't just folk music for hippies, and there was somehow rock music for soldiers in Vietnam. That this was music that spoke to a huge swath of America: black, white, rich, poor, people on service overseas, people protesting the war at home. It gives you that. You know, by looking at this snapshot from this single year, you get the sense of just the enormous reach of Dylan, both in the United States and abroad, too. You know, we have a huge cluster of letters from the Nordic countries, from Italy. We can track these unexpected sort of hotspots of Dylan fandom in the early 60s.
And what about, you know, the fact that you said that a lot of them are from just post the Going Electric at the Newport Folk Festival. Any reactions to that, positive or negative?
You know, I think the interesting thing is, at least of the letters, we haven't even had a chance to read all of these yet because we've just finished the process of opening them. But you don't actually see a lot of fans being outraged. Most of them are writing in support. There's not this, I think this myth that like somehow this was the moment Dylan betrayed his fans is, these letters kind of helped disprove. I think the letters were willing to follow Dylan in whatever creative direction he was willing to go. In fact, one of the really interesting things we found in the letters is a number of people are sending Dylan songs they've written, hoping he'll perform them, right? That they're hearing in his voice the things they want to say. And this is like poets, you know, exchanging poems with one another. There's something that's touched them so deeply they want to write creatively in response to Dylan.
Yeah, that certainly has an interesting aspect to it. Elvis Costello was involved in selecting a jukebox of 152 songs. What are those songs and why Elvis Costello? I mean, I would have thought to get to curate something in and around Dylan's works, there'd be a long queue around the block for that one.
Well, I imagine that queue is still quite long, actually. But this jukebox they've set up in there is sort of amazing. It's just kind of a fancy, Spotify playlist or something. But I think the idea is that different artists will come in at different time and curate this in different ways. But Costello shares with Dylan, I think, a nearly encyclopedic knowledge of sort of folk and American music and traditions. And in some sense, he was the perfect fit for this. He can hear in Dylan's songs the traces that go back to the old blues, the really original covers, maybe of that later artists made of Dylan's work. So I think it's Costello's just extremely deep musical knowledge that made him the ideal curator for this initial installation of the jukebox.
Yeah, and Dylan himself has donated an iron gate to the centre, I believe. Do you think, do we know, has he visited? He didn't turn up for the Nobel Prize award. Has he visited? Will he visit? Do they know?
He certainly wasn't here for the opening, all the opening events. In fact, his tour had come here about 2.5 weeks before the center actually opened, which felt almost deliberate. Like he wanted to make sure he was not in town when the center opens. And my own sense of Dylan is he's too busy making the new stuff. And he's still clearly active as an artist, as a sculptor, as a songwriter. He's got this new album out. He's touring it, Rough and Rowdy Ways. I don't think he has much interest in stopping to look back to see how other people are remembering him. Dylan's always been indifferent to what other people might be thinking of the music he's trying to make.
Too busy moving forward, and long may he continue to do so. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Sean.
Of course, it's a great pleasure. Yep, take care.
That's Sean Latham there, Professor of English and Comparative Literature and Director of the Institute for Bob Dylan Studies at the University of Tulsa, and that new Bob Dylan Center on Reconciliation Way in Tulsa. If you want to get an idea of what's involved in the center, you could visit their website, which is bobdylancenter.com, and that's center with the American spelling C-E-N-T-E-R, bobdylancenter.com. Everything I Know About Love starts on BBC One and the BBC iPlayer this June, brings it with it a fair amount of buzz. The series has been created by Dolly Alderton, based on her own acclaimed memoir. Semi-fictionalised adaptation tells the story of childhood friends Maggie and Bertie as they move into a house in London and navigate life, love and friendship in their 20s. The show stars Emma Appleton and Belle Poley alongside Marley Sue and Ailea Odofin as these four people at the, really it's the four of them at the centre of it. Jen Gannon has been watching. You've watched four of the episodes, I think.
Four at this of the point. Seven. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, about Dolly Alderton and the book on which the series is based, Jen.
Yeah, I think people of a certain age will have some idea who she is. She is a journalist and a podcaster, and she is known for being a chronicler of the millennial girl, I'd say, experience. And she had a very successful dating column in the Sunday Times, and has graduated just to being a Sunday Times columnist. And she writes an advice column in the Style magazine as well, which is hugely popular. And she had a podcast, The High Low, with Pandora Sykes, a fellow journalist, that tackles weekly current affairs and pop culture in this very free wheeling, inclusive manner, and that won her a lot of fans. And she ended up writing this memoir, Everything I Know About Love, that delved into the specific whirlwind of her twenties, like her twenties in London when she moved to Camden,
which was kind of in the 2012, I think, is the year that we're the opening episode is set in. At any rate,
and it's been adapted by Dolly Alderton is, you know, writing it for the screen as well, so she has a big hand in this. And it's the work entitled production company, so they're responsible for Bridget Jones' Diary and Notting Hill, and I think those films kind of set the tone for the series itself.
Right. Okay, well, let's have a listen to a clip featuring Emma Appleton as Maggie, and she's telling us about fate. This is really what this opening sequence is about, how the opening episode in fact is called Destiny. And here she is, she gives us a little bit of voiceover, then she's on a train ordering some drinks, but she's short of money, but there's a handsome stranger across the aisle played by Connor Finch, and he comes to the rescue.
Destiny. The thing that I believed predetermined all great love stories. The idea that the romantic events of our lives were scripted in stardust long, long ago. I just had to follow the signs to find them. This particular tale of destiny begins on a train. The year is 2012. According to the Mayan calendar, the world is about to end, which would have been a real bummer because I was 24 and my adult life had just finally begun.
Please, can I get a mini bottle of red wine? And a mini bottle of white wine.
And a mini bottle of Jameson.
Yeah, that card's been declined.
Definitely not.
Definitely has.
I checked my online banking at the station. There is loads of money in my account. And by loads, I mean £32.74.
Says you've been sufficient funds.
I'll get it.
No, don't worry.
So that same order again for Shane McGowan. And just a beer for me, please.
Connor Finch then coming up with the money on the train for Maggie, as played by Emma Appleton in that opening episode of Everything I Know About Love, which is about to come to the BBC. She's very watchable, Emma Appleton. She's kind of very right for this part.
Yeah, she's really charismatic, and I think she's very good at capturing that kind of kinetic energy that you expect from Dolly Alderton if you know her. Like, she's all legs and fringe, and she's hyperverbal, and she's very much lost in her romanticised notions about destiny and the way her life is going to open up in London in her 20s. And she is determined to make the most of this, like, and she calls it the grubby golden phase of her life that is so short-lived, and she tells that to her best friend, who actually is played really well by Belle Powley. I think she's a great actress. She has this very spirited kookiness to her, even though she's kind of the straight man of this.
It's really about, first of all, that friendship,
it
but
is.
Really the four women, the four young women in their flat in London. That's really where this story lies.
It's a celebration of the tight bonds of female friendship, and it really concentrates on that frame of time where, you know, you're drinking, you're partying to excess, you have jobs that are like endurance tests, and you have men's names in your phone that have no surname, they just exist in your phone. That kind of time, and that's been rich source material for a lot of different shows. You've had, you know, older kind of women, Sex and the City, but you've had Drifters, you'd had Sharon Horgan's really underrated Pulling, which I think this owes a major debt to, and obviously the comparison that nobody wants to make, Lena Dunham's Girls, which I think
even though they're very different beasts, its presence does loom large over the series, definitely.
Well, here's the scene between Emma Appleton as Maggie again and Birdie, the best friend. They've been best friends since school. Really. Belle Powley playing, and they're chatting in bed after a night out, and Maggie, as usual, has spent too much money.
I spent all my money again last night, buying drinks for a load of people I'll never ever see again.
Why did you buy them drinks?
To make them like me without having to talk.
I'll lend you.
You can't lend me any more money. I'll just go back to the bank and see if they'll let me extend my overdraft.
I thought you already went last week and they said no.
I'll try again.
Yeah, I don't think it works like a tombola.
I'm such an idiot.
No, you're not. You're so fun.
I'm the tragic chunk who buys all the rounds.
You think being fun is easy because it comes naturally to you, but being fun is not easy. You're someone who actually likes skinny dipping and wearing bandanas and playing snooker at the pub and putting hot sauce on everything. Now that's special. Maybe the cost of being that special is always being overdrawn.
Emma Appleton and Belle Powley there in a scene from Everything I Know About Love. Jen Gannon has been watching the opening four episodes for us. So to what extent then is the series about, you know, presenting this period of your 20s or really analysing it and kind of looking at, do you want to be part of that, what seems vacuous, or is there something else going on?
It's not analytical at all. It's a very sweet tribute. Like I said, it's kind of Richard Curtis in its mould. Whereas I think, you know, I think Dolly Alderton, obviously, because it's based on her life, she's extremely fond of these characters. So there, it isn't like Girls in the way that I know that there is very valid criticism levelled against Lena Dunham and Girls as a show, but we never consider how much she actually skewered her generation and was quite self-aware in some ways, and it poked fun at millennials and, you know, was very vicious in its assessments at times about these characters who are shallow, spoiled, self-involved. Whereas someone like Maggie in this show can be a bit like a manic pixie dream girl and is, you know, overindulgent, and but it's very genteel in, it doesn't really go further enough. There's nothing to it. It feels very slight.
And what about the how sexuality is portrayed here? Because obviously we're dealing with these four young women in their 20s and the beginning of that exploration, that side of their lives.
I think that was the most illuminating and intriguing part for me, was when you actually see them get into grips with Tinder, the early days of Tinder, and you see Amara and Maggie have this, there's a gorgeously liberating montage in episode four where they do, you know, female sexuality represented on screen is usually tinged with fear, fear of pregnancy, fear of sexual assault, whereas this is shown as something very breezy and fun, and that's why I think it's very satisfying and important to see them enjoying their sexuality. And I think that's where the show actually is successful, because it shows them, you know, enjoying this without any guilt, enjoying them on the same terms as their male counterparts, and I think that's very important. But it is a bubbly and frothy take on your 20s. You're not going to get anything deeper than that from
but
it.
But I'm guessing too that you want a soundtrack to the 2012s. Is there a good soundtrack here that will just bring you right back to that period in
there
time?
There is, but there's a lot of, you know, very sweet, when they're living together, you know, they do dance routines by Five that they learned in school, or Kylie Minogue, Love at First Sight. Like, there is little flashbacks to their school days, and I think that's very going to be so relatable for so many people, and I think it will become escapist viewing for a lot of people. But for me, sometimes I felt like Jarvis and Common People. I was watching this conventionally beautiful fun time Maggie wander through Camden with this awareness that she lives in this cosseted dream world, and it didn't feel, there's no realism to it. And I think we're very used to now seeing representations like something like I May Destroy You or Normal People or Girls or even something like Fleabag, where you can see they have very strong themes in it and you see this bitter reality to it, where this is very sweet and fanciful and dreamlike, I think.
All right. Jen Gannon speaking to us there about Everything I Know About Love starts on June the 7th on BBC One. Tomorrow night,